You're listening to event audio from the Brookings Events Podcast, part of the Brookings Podcast Network. For more in-depth analysis and commentary from Brookings scholars and our guests, go to brookings.edu/podcasts or subscribe to Brookings Podcasts through iTunes or your favorite podcast app. You can also follow us on Twitter at Policy Podcasts.
Good afternoon, everyone. My name is Homi Karas. I'm the director of the Global Economy and Development Program here at Brookings. So it's my real pleasure this afternoon to introduce our discussion on Beyond GDP. I think we all know that GDP has many flaws as a metric of welfare, but I think we should also bear in mind that it has been the workhorse measure of how economies are doing ever since it was introduced by Simon Kuznets in 1937. So this is a metric that has a pedigree of well over 80 years and is not something to be discarded lightly. So there are lots of reasons, I think, to move beyond GDP. GDP doesn't measure a number of the things that we care about. We care a lot about environmental externalities, for example. We care a lot about the unpaid work that many women in particular do across the globe. One of my colleagues at Brookings, Carol Graham, has written a lot about non-material aspects of welfare, including hope and optimism and other indicators of happiness. None of these are measured in formal GDP. So it's clearly not something that is a full measure of individual well-being and prosperity. And I think that also we should recognize that GDP and GDP growth tends to be quite volatile. When we look at the experience across countries, growth rates over a decade are not very well correlated with growth rates over the next decade. So, you know, countries that do reasonably well don't necessarily do well in the following decade. And so I think that there's long been a quest for some kind of alternative measure that would give us a sense of what one might call sustainable growth rather than just actual growth of the moment. And that, I think, is really going to be the focus of our discussion this afternoon. So what we're going to do is we're going to have a short PowerPoint by Glenn-Marie Lang and Quentin Woden, both economists at the World Bank who have just co-edited a volume called The Changing Wealth of Nations 2018. It's the second, I believe, in what will be a series over time, extremely comprehensive, covering 141 countries over 20 years. So this is a volume with a wealth of information in it, and it's, I believe, available outside if any of you would like to look at it in more detail. It's also available online. After that presentation, we'll move into a panel discussion. The panel discussion will be moderated by David Pilling. He's the Africa editor of the Financial Times and himself the author of The Growth Delusion, Wealth, Poverty, and the Well-Being of Nations, also available outside. So I hope that you go away from this afternoon with lots of good reading material to help you understand these issues a little bit better. So we've got a really wonderful panel. We have Kristalina Georgieva. She is the CEO of the World Bank. She's a former commissioner of the European Union for International Cooperation and Humanitarian Aid, a former vice president of the European Commission, a former co-chair of the UN Secretary General's High-Level Panel on Humanitarian Financing. Kristalina, it's a wonderful pleasure to have you here. We have Professor Dale Jorgensen, the Samuel W. Morris Professor at Harvard, His extraordinary career spans, many aspects of econometrics and growth theory, and I am particularly privileged to introduce him because he taught me econometrics as a graduate student some 41 years ago. And Dale, I'd like to thank you on behalf of all of your students over the years. Before you think that that's a compliment, just look at some of the errors I've made in some papers that I've submitted for publication. Andrew Steer is the president and CEO of the World Resources Institute. WRI has just been named one of the outstanding think tanks on environment and sustainability issues in the think tank rankings that have just come out. Congratulations on that, Andrew. And then finally, we have our own Danny Kaufman. I'd like to introduce Danny as a non-resident senior fellow in our global program. Unfortunately, he also has a day job, which is to be the CEO of the Natural Resources Governance Institute, which is a major player in the push for transparency around the utilization of natural resources in the world. So I look forward to a wonderful panel. The event is being a webcast. We encourage you to use the hashtag BeyondGDP when tweeting. And as some of you have already found, there are some sandwiches and refreshments outside to my left over here. And after the event, please feel free to have some. With that, let me ask Quentin and Glenn-Marie to start with their presentation.
I'd like to thank you all for coming here today. We're really excited to have this opportunity to tell you about our new report, The Changing Wealth of Nations 2018, Building a Sustainable Future. This is the latest in a series of reports the World Bank has done on wealth accounting. So let me start by explaining why the World Bank thinks it's important to measure wealth. Some years back, Joseph Stiglitz, Nobel laureate and our former chief economist, commented that private companies are always assessed on the basis of both their income statement and their balance sheet, their net wealth. That's because a company can always increase its current income by selling off assets. But this is a short-term strategy that would undermine the long-term financial viability of any company. He noted, however, that countries, on the other hand, only report on their national income or GDP, and we know nothing about the assets that underpin and produce GDP. If we want to continue to maintain GDP in the future, we must maintain the assets that produce it. GDP measures current national income. Wealth measures the prospects for generating that income into the future. These two indicators are complementary, and both are needed to measure the economic health of a national economy and sustainability. It's for this reason, a better measure of sustainability, that the World Bank thinks it's important to measure wealth. In the early 2000s, the World Bank launched an initiative to fill the information gap about national wealth. Our latest report, as Homi mentioned, estimates the wealth for 141 countries over 20 years. We define wealth measured in market prices very broadly to be comprehensive. It includes produced capital, the infrastructure, buildings, machinery, and equipment that we're all pretty much familiar with. It includes natural capital, minerals and energy resources, agricultural and forest land, protected areas. We're still missing some important components of natural capital like water, renewable energy resources, and fisheries and others. The book discusses how we might move forward to fill this gap in future work. For the very first time, we're able to measure human capital explicitly, and this is one of the major innovations of this report on the wealth of nations. And, of course, we also include net foreign assets, a relatively small but critical component of wealth. Viewed from the lens of wealth, development is about building and managing a diverse portfolio of assets. With this introduction, let me turn to some of our global results. My colleague Quentin Woden will then come and discuss some of the detailed results for natural capital and human capital. So global wealth grew by 66% between 1995 and 2014. The most striking feature was an increase in the share of global wealth held by the middle-income countries in the light blue and orange there. They increased their share from 19 to 28% of global wealth by 2014. Of course, much of this was due to rapid growth in Asia, especially the large economies of India and China, but also smaller countries like Vietnam and Bangladesh. The share of global wealth held by sub-Saharan African countries, on the other hand, remained unchanged. But we don't want to look just at how total wealth changed. We need to look at how wealth per capita changed. That's because the amount of wealth per person determines the GDP per person that a country can produce. The low-income countries, all the way on the left, many in Africa, nearly doubled their wealth, shown in the light blue bar, increasing wealth at a faster rate than the global average of 66%. But higher population growth in these low-income countries means that per capita wealth, the dark blue bar, grew only 17%, far below the global average of roughly 30%. Despite the growth of global wealth, great disparities remain. Here is the average wealth per capita across the different income groups. We see that high-income OECD countries like Canada, the U.S., Australia, Great Britain, and so on, still hold far more wealth per person than the others. At roughly $700,000 per person on average, this was 52 times the wealth in low-income countries, which averaged just under $14,000 per person. These income group averages hide a great deal of variation among countries within each of these groups. Total wealth grew everywhere, but per capita wealth did not. Let's consider the ones that grew the fastest, those in green. That's where per capita wealth increased at least 100% over these 20 years. These include countries like China and India, Vietnam, Bangladesh, Sri Lanka, some countries in Latin America, like Peru and Chile, and some others. Africa shows a great mix of experience, with some fairly high performers like Rwanda and Ethiopia, and others where wealth per capita actually declined. What we found was per capita wealth stagnated, meaning somewhere around 0 up to 5% per person, or declined in about 25 countries for a variety of reasons, and you can see them highlighted in pink and orange here. Most of these countries were fragile conflict states with high population growth, countries like Zimbabwe, Madagascar, Lebanon, or Papua New Guinea. The 2009 financial crisis even hit some of the high-income OECD countries like Greece and Spain, which are now expected to be recovering. With this brief overview, let me now hand over to my colleague Quentin to talk a little bit in more detail about the natural capital and human capital.
So Glenn-Marie went through some of the key findings of the report in terms of the broad trends in wealth and in per capita wealth by income groups or by regions. The second part of this brief presentation is about giving you a bit more of a flavor for some of the results related to natural capital and human capital especially. So these first slides gives you the share of total wealth of the main three types of capital: produced capital, natural capital, and human capital. And what you can see is that for produced capital, with the exceptions of low-income countries where the share is lower, there's not that much of a change depending on the development level of the countries. Produced capital accounts for about one-fourth of the total. But you see a major shift between natural capital and human capital. So natural capital remains the largest component of wealth at 47% of the total in low-income countries, but then it shrinks as a share of wealth to 3% in high-income OECD countries. And by contrast, human capital increases over time. So if you think about two countries, think, for example, about the Democratic Republic of Congo that Glenn Murray mentioned, you realize there is a lot of wealth that is represented by natural capital, whether it's minerals, whether it's forest, whether it's agricultural land. And you think about Switzerland, if you don't account for ski slopes, there's actually very little natural capital. It's less than 1% of the total. So let's look a little bit more in details at trends as countries develop in natural capital. So what you have on these slides is in blue the share of total wealth, what I just presented before, of natural capital that declines as countries reach higher levels of economic development. But what you have in orange is the actual level of natural capital per person, per capita. And this is an important point. In absolute value, natural capital is actually higher in high-income OECD countries than it is in low-income countries, about three times higher. And so the message that we want to give here is that we are not talking about liquidating natural capital for other investments. We actually have to invest as well in natural capital, including in renewables. Now, this slide shows you some of the main components of natural capital in per capita values for the world as a whole over time, from 1995 to 2014. And what you see is that the absolute value per person of natural capital has increased. The area that you see that has increased the most in gray actually represents fossil fuels. Now, this takes into account both the reserves, the proven reserves that countries have, as well as prices. And it's important to note that in the 20 years represented by this graph, oil prices, for example, tripled. But even the value of minerals has increased, and importantly, the value of agricultural land, which is in orange in the slide, also increased, both because the areas being cultivated increased and because the value per hectare of the land increased as well. What also emerges from this graph, and that's sometimes not realized, is that among all sources of natural capital, the renewable sources actually represent a larger share of the total than the non-renewable, which points again to the importance of managing those resources well. Now, in the same way that the previous slide, two slides ago, represented the trend as a share of natural capital and the levels in absolute value of natural capital across income groups, this shows you the same picture for human capital. And as I mentioned it, human capital as a share increases. It accounts for about 70% of total wealth in high-income OECD countries. But what is really striking is the gap between low-income countries and high-income countries in the values. What you have is that human capital is about 90 times higher in high-income countries versus low-income countries. And maybe I should just say, how do we measure this? Human capital is computed as the value today of the future earnings from the labor force. And the two main authors or innovators are Dale Jorgensen and Barbara Fromini, who are both here. What we did is apply their methodology to 141 countries, but the idea of measuring human capital as the discounted value of future earnings from the labor force comes from them. Now, these graphs makes it clear that as countries develop, you really have to invest for your competitivity, for the ability of generating future income in human capital. And I just want to mention a few of the topics that we are working now on using those data. So one aspect of those data is that they can be used for cost-benefit analysis. We can, for example, look at how would a reduction in child malnutrition change human capital wealth for countries. What's the value of that? Or we can look at how much would human capital increase if you were providing better education for girls. So all of this is feasible and made easier through those data as examples of applications. Now, one of the applications that is in the book and on which we are doing more work as well is about gender. What we find is that women account for less than 40% of global earnings, and that essentially means human capital, the total value of future earnings for the labor force. But then, if women were earning as much as men, this would mean that human capital wealth would increase. And what that graph shows is that that increase would be especially high in South Asia. And it would also be larger in low-income and lower-middle-income countries than is the case for richer countries. Now, to summarize, so what have we learned from this whole exercise? So first, and that's the good news, global wealth increased by about two-thirds over the 20-year period that we looked at. And as Glenn-Marie mentioned it, the upper-middle-income countries actually are slowly catching up with high-income countries, and they account now for a much larger share of total wealth. Per capita wealth increased as well globally, but by one-third only, and the difference is population growth. And as Glenn-Marie mentioned, the impact of population growth varies depending on which countries you look at. Human capital is the biggest component of wealth. Natural capital is still extremely important, of course, especially, again, in low-income countries. And the rents, the earnings from natural capital, have to be invested properly to drive future growth, especially in those countries. And the broader message that we want to give you and how we hope that these data will be used by many of you is that the composition of wealth is important and that countries need to manage that composition of wealth, the different assets they have, the portfolio of assets for long-term sustainable growth. Thank you.
Thank you very much for that opening presentation and for the what I thought were excellent graphics as well. I'd also like to welcome our online audience and, of course, everybody who's in the room today. As we've heard, you know, ever since GDP's conception and invention in the 1930s, its inventor, Simon Kuznets, had doubts about the measure that he unleashed on the world. And yet it's been very enduring for many good reasons. It's very concrete. It tells us something that that you can make policy around. Given that, Kristalina, why has the World Bank become so involved and put really so much capital, if I could use that word, political capital, behind... looking for alternatives and looking for, and we should be clear what this alternative is, really the balance sheet that is the complement to the flow measure, the income and production measure that is GDP.
First, many thanks to Brookings for bringing us here. I think the presentation gave a very clear answer. We know more about the capacity of countries to meet their development objectives when we complement GDP with understanding the asset underpinning for producing this GDP.
Yes.
It is like a return on what you have. If I can just go back in history, I have this incredible privilege to have been there when this work was put on tracks. And I don't see in the audience Kirk Hamilton, one of the original authors of this report. But I very clearly remember the discussions we had on Beyond GDP and the necessity to give decision makers a clear understanding on what they have and how they can turn it into prosperity for the future. The most important element of this report is that it is policy informative. In other words, if you look at the world as a whole or you look at a particular country, knowing the compositions of assets is very clearly able to inform your decisions, your policy decisions. For example, if you are rich of non-renewable natural capital, you can extract it, but you have to invest the rent you get from this extraction into education and health or physical capital or renewable natural capital so you can sustain your progress. And if you carefully assess how countries are performing, it is so very obvious that there are some pressing policy issues to be addressed. For example, population growth. So many countries today have population growth that way exceeds what they can sustain and still get better off in the future. And yet, we all have to admit that our collective attention to policies that bring a more sustainable population growth has been a bit underwhelming. We know what they are: get boys and girls in school, keep them there, make sure that there is family planning, that health services are accessible to women. I could go on. And yet, it has not been such a strong focus of policy. And yet, if you go back to what the graph has shown, it is so clear that we have a set of countries where people are getting either not better off or they're getting worse off, and we are not aggressively addressing that. So from the perspective of the World Bank, yes, it feels good to have this report. It is actually the third we have issued. It is a great report, but much more importantly, it helps us in informing policies we engage countries we work with for the well-being of their people.
Thank you. I mean, to be clear, some countries could be producing very good GDP results, very fast GDP, but their wealth might be declining, particularly in per capita terms.
Could I just quote you? You have this great story of the two men that illustrates how GDP is misleading. If people haven't read the story, please do, and I'm sure reading this book would help you too.
Thank you.
It basically says that if you only take GDP, it is driving with only a semi-good outlook on the road ahead. And you shouldn't do that. It is absolutely paramount that this notion of complementing GDP with wealth analysis is adopted by the research community and by the policy community.
Thank you. Let me turn to Dale Jorgensen, because one of the most interesting aspects of this report is the new methods of calculating human capital. Human capital in previous World Bank reports was really a residual. It was just what was left over. We knew it must be there, but we didn't really know how to measure it. This report goes one stage further and actually puts a number on human capital and finds that human capital is, 70% of the wealth in all countries, is that right? Or in wealth in all countries?
Yeah, that's right.
Could you tell us a little bit, without too much detail, but just a little bit about the methodology? How are we actually calculating the human capital?
Well, the key idea, and I think it's very important to underline this before we launch into the specifics, is the idea that this really transforms the nature of the calculations of wealth that the World Bank has been doing, as we just heard, for more than a decade, and of course this goes back to work on sustainability in the World Bank and elsewhere. The key thing in the innovation that David just described is the idea that human capital should be measured with information that is specific to the countries and the regions and the world economy that are to be captured by this very, very important measure. The idea of using lifetime labor income is intuitive. It turns out that that is the idea of wealth in the form of the labor resources that people bring to the economy and to the world markets every day. But what we found as a result of this pioneering research is that this turns out to be the most important element of sustainability. It's 70% of the value of wealth for large countries like the OECD, as we saw. It's by far the largest component. So in order to deal with the issue of sustainability, we must deal with the issue of measuring human capital. So as a result of exploration in the World Bank and elsewhere, people begin to look around to different measures of human capital, and there are many, many of them, and ask the question, which measure will fit best into the World Bank framework for dealing with the issues related to sustainability? And it soon arrived as a conclusion that the key idea was to take data for individual countries that measures income over the whole lifetime of each member of the labor force and treat that as the value of human capital. It's only then that you bring out the details. How much detail did this study provide? The study includes specific measures of human capital for 141 countries. And this is based on a resource that the World Bank itself brought to the research bench, so to speak, through its work on poverty and inequality in what is called the International Database for Income Distribution. This is something that had been used primarily by the World Bank for measuring poverty and inequality. The key leap that is the foundation for this innovation is the idea of bringing that to bear on sustainability through the idea of human capital. So these three ideas came together: sustainability, human capital, and the data set for individual countries that provided lifetime income. So this is a major contribution to economic measurement. It's something that's going to resonate through the field of economic development, through the field of economic growth. And I'd like to congratulate Quentin and Glenn-Marie and their co-authors on putting together a magnificent study with many important new ideas that are going to be fruitful sources of research ideas for decades. Congratulations.
I think it's important to note that embedded within those numbers for lifetime earnings are, of course, health, skills, the basic education that underpins. So, because, of course, that will determine, crudely, the lifetime earnings of people, what they bring, as you say, to the market. So this is not just a calculation of wages. There's a lot that's implicit within that. I mean, I want to move on to natural capital in a second, but could I just ask you very briefly, was there anything that leapt out of you looking at those numbers in 141 countries?
I'm sorry?
What leapt out at you?
What leapt out at me was the fact that this is the driving force in sustainability. It's the number that you have to make precise in order to use the ideas that originally motivated the study that we just heard about, namely the World Bank's objective of trying to understand this concept of what makes sustainable growth. Mm-hmm. How do we deal with the race, if you like, between the increase in population and the increase in wealth? The key idea turns out to be this idea of human wealth. And so that is essentially the lesson that leaps out at me.
Thank you. And Andrew, if I could bring you in now, and if we could talk about natural capital, because one of the things that comes out of this report is natural capital plays a huge role in poor countries, but then as they become wealthier and hopefully use that natural capital well, they build up other forms of capital, and then natural capital diminishes in proportional terms, but absolutely not in absolute terms, because if you're ruining your natural capital, you don't have anything left for future wealth. First of all, how robust do you think these numbers are? And do you wish that other forms of natural capital, renewable natural capital, were also included here in these numbers?
Yes, I do. but first, look, congratulations, Glenn-Marie. Crystalline, the fact you as the CEO are sitting up here and talking about this, this is a great blessing, and well done to the World Bank. I had the privilege of being the director of environment of the World Bank about 15 years ago. So did Crystalina, actually. And I remember when we set up this little unit called the True Wealth of Nations unit with John Dixon and Kirk Hamilton and people like that. And my goodness, you've come a long way, and well done. And I particularly like the fact that you also make, for example, the point that it's not just about running down your capital that's natural and building it up in education, although that is a very good thing to do. You actually can invest in your natural capital, mm-hmm. and actually natural capital in rich countries is actually worth more than it is in low-income countries. But yeah, look, this is a journey we're on, and I might come out in a slightly different place, in the sense of I would have liked some of the non-marketed natural capitals to be included. So, for example, what we do here in this book, and it's very legitimate because you have to have data for 197 countries, and therefore, if you don't have all the data, you can't really include it. But take, for example, a mangrove. The way we measure it here is the value of the mangrove is the forest products you could get out of it, and that's about $800 for a hectare. But actually, if you look at the ecosystem values, it's $36,000. You know, and that's because it protects against flooding, but it also is the home of fish being born and all kinds of things like that. So I think the book is very honest. It has a chapter 11, which is terrific. Start with the last chapter, because that is actually what's the next report is going to have to do. But there are some interesting things here, if you think about it. I mean, take, for example, fossil fuels that are in the ground. Now, this report legitimately says, okay, we've got to measure them. So if you're Saudi Arabia, it's what's under the ground. Well, yes, and then imagine you could keep selling it. Well, yeah, but what about the sunshine that we have today? I mean, coal under the ground or oil under the ground is simply a bottled sunshine. It just happened to come here 4 million years ago, but actually this sunshine coming today. It's dead easy to measure the solar potential you have today. And that is actually even more valuable than what's under the ground. And so the next edition needs to sort of look at that as well. And I think the fact it doesn't is perfectly legitimate for this time around, but we do need to move towards that. There's another issue with fossil fuels, of course, which is, you know, are we actually going to be able to sell them all? And probably no, because if we're going to deal with climate change, actually we'll have to keep half of it under the ground. So should we be assuming you can keep selling it? So look, this is a journey. Just one final thing. Sounds like I'm grumbling, but I love this book, by the way. It's a fun book. How do we measure the value of capital here? It's by assuming that you can market something, and then you discount it back to the present. And so you use a discount rate of 4%. Well, it sounds reasonable, except that $100 100 years from now is worth $2 today if you discount it at 4%. Doesn't really give the sense that you really care about sustainability, does it? Now, Nick Stern in the Stern report says, let's, instead of having 4%, let's have 1.4%. That way, $100 would be worth $25 today if you discount it back. At least is so. I would recommend two things for the the next edition. One, to do some sensitivity, say, look, this is what it was, but let's assume a lower discount rate as well. And there's very legitimate disagreements here, by the way. And the second thing, I'd take chapter 11, which is a fabulous chapter, and I'd say, imagine we could measure these, and we've got sort of rough back of the envelope. What would it do? Because, you see, the only problem is, if you say that natural capital to rich countries is only 3% of their wealth, why bother? Because, in fact, they need clean air, clean water, and ecosystems just as much as anybody else.
So I don't want to start a battle of the capitals, but do you think that natural capital is, in a sense, underrepresented in the numbers?
Oh, I think the report's very honest. It is.
Yes.
Very honest about that. It is seriously underestimated, yes.
Okay, Danny, if I could now bring you in. As I was saying before, human capital used to be a kind of a residual in these numbers, but there was more in there than just human capital. There was what you might call institutional capital. Partha Dasgupta, who you probably know at Cambridge, tells a story of two islands. They both have exactly the same wealth. They start off in exactly the same place, but one has absolute trust and one has no trust at all. And very soon, the island with more trust begins to exceed the island with no trust because it could trade and specialize and all of that. And that is, in a sense, a kind of shorthand for institutions. So is institutional capital, does it exist in this report or has it been squeezed out? Should we try to measure that? Or is it somehow
in between
there? Okay.
It's in between. First, I echo whatever was said. Congratulations, Cristalina, the World Bank. Let me perhaps summarizing what was said. I think this is potentially transformative, and I'll discuss and build on what was said very quickly on both potentially and transformative. First, I think it's really important, and that's a great contribution of your book, David, to make a clear distinction between flows and stocks and the importance, just like at a personal level in my organization, we have to manage a balance sheet as well as an income mm-hmm. statement. So that's yep. absolutely clear. And the mm-hmm. World Bank has been working on this for a decade, and this is another leap forward in this context, really important. At the same time, there are real contributions which are a bit buried in the report that I will think that it's important for everybody to look at, which is also about the flows. So how to complement GDP and go forward? The net savings measure is not a stock measure, which is very important, and very important for our work regarding natural resources. Now, potentially transformative. My own country, Chile, very rich, subsoil resources, particularly copper, forever, didn't develop too much until some decades ago when they put all the institutions and everything in place. Major transformation is in very dark green there. Of course, I'm biased. I'm from there. But just compare with an Equatorial Guinea and so many other countries that have not done well in transforming the natural wealth, in transforming the natural resources into human capital, which is absolutely crucial, productive capital, and then GDP. So we need to think about that transformation. It's, in a sense, a value chain. Now, what's not in slide 2, which is a key one, showing the value chain, is governance and institutions, which is absolutely crucial mediating factor to convert, to transform, first, from the natural capital to the next stage, which is human capital, productive capital, GDP, and ultimately well-being. Great slide, but that should be center front. Of course, we all know that it's incredibly difficult. So it's not just trust. I mean, rule of law. What about rule of law? What about corruption? What about freedom of the press, civic space? All those things that we know now, and we have measured it, the extent to that matters for not only income per capita in the long term, which we have done with my colleague at the World Bank, R. Cray, and with all the worldwide governance indicators, major 3-to-1 ratios in terms of per capita income at a higher governance level. So that's missing, but not totally, because it is, to some extent, embedded in the calculations of the future flows and net present value at market prices. The problem is that it's not sufficiently differentiated by the quality of those institutions, the quality of governance today, and also discussing, as Andrew said, for for the environment, different scenarios. We just produced another report, which could be very useful in this context, which measures the quality of governance, accountability, and transparency for the resource-relevant countries and rates them. I would submit that it's really important to integrate as an addition to the discount rate, which could be 4 or 1.5%, depending on that, but the governance factor, because if we would have done that, this exercise, 10, 20 years ago, or Venezuela, or the Zimbabwes of this world, the path would have looked very differently than the Chile. And then the other thing is, it is really important to think hard, and there are ways that we can work together in terms of also measuring that institutional yes. capital, but it should not be added just as another fourth pillar, because it basically it's embedded. It's an umbrella issue that is critical for what I call the transformation. And that potential transformation will not and does not happen if that those institutions are not in place. So a lot of this subsoil wealth just stays on the ground.
Let me ask you a very specific question about Chile versus, say, Equatorial Guinea. What is it in Chile that, if you could bottle it, could help other countries make that transition? Because, I mean, Chile had very many political systems. It went from Allende to Pinochet to the Christian Democrats. It's had centre-right governments. You know, it's had Ricardo Lagos, Bachelet, but then it's also had, is it Piñera? So it's you've had a very varied political system, and yet you've had this, you know, fairly smooth transition from copper to these other forms of capital. So what is it about Chile?
Well, in a nutshell, and of course there are many ways of skinning a cat, and everybody has their own view. But bottom line is that Chile, when the dictator leaves 1989, because he thought that he would win the plebiscite, because the country was starting to grow again, but instead it was yes or no for him to stay. The country voted no, so he has to leave. Poverty was 45% of the population was below the poverty line. Nowadays, it's in the low teens, and 10%. That is an absolutely crucial turning point when new leadership comes. Also, in new cadre, it becomes generational. It's once it becomes a democratic country again.
Yes.
Whether it's been center-left or center-right, there has been a complete consensus and absolutely crucial importance of institution
yes.
with macroeconomic management or yeah. what we believe in.
So institutional solidity took hold.
Absolutely. And yes. there is an institutional foundation. Now, we have our scandals and problems, and we had recently some corruption scandal. Just to make it very clear, governance, good governance in a country is not the absence of misgovernance not having any corruption scandal. It's the resilience and ability institutionally to respond to that. Homi has written about that, about Asia, some Asian countries on that. Chile has that too. So we are no angels.
Yes. Let me turn back to you, Kristalina. I mean, one of the sort of points of this report really is as you say, this is information that governments can use. So if you're a government in a poor or moderately poor country and you're looking at your, you know, various capital levels, how do you get from here to there? What are the lessons in this report for a government?
Let me start from where Danny left it. And it is that rule of law and institutions that function in a transparent manner is a prerequisite to make good use of the assets you have. Zimbabwe has no reason to be poor, except for poor governments, failures of governance, and let's hope that now with a page being turned, that particular lesson will be put to work. When you have a more inclusive government where different perspectives can be put forward, then that translates into carefully crafted policies that make the best of the assets you have. If you are to be a resource-rich economy, then how you invest for a long time the extraction of resources and how you turn this rent into benefit broadly for the population, that is your key for success. Look at Norway. If you are rich on renewable natural resources, mm-hmm. and I agree with Andrew that we have to get deeper into understanding that, how you manage it in a sustainable manner, and again, how you lift up the value of what you have by having good certification, by having a way that what is in your hands goes the longest possible mile for mm-hmm. your people. And of course, recognize that we also have countries that are poor on natural resources. They need to look at ways in which the little they have can turn into a good built-in capital and, of course, in skilled populations. What we have seen time and again is that a careful analysis and understanding of assets combined with good governance goes a very long way, and I would add here, and bringing more women up in the chain of command in a country, that goes a very long way for countries that are not particularly rich to get to a to be on a sustainable path and to get their people to live better lives. And then we also see, and I want to say that for the fairness of it, that even countries that are well governed, they also depend on what is happening around them. Mm-hmm. In the report, we have the case of Lebanon. Actually, it would be exactly the same impact in Jordan. When country's wealth is going up, but wealth per capita is falling drastically. If I remember it correctly, wealth per capita in Lebanon dropped 38%, minus 38%. Why? Because Lebanon is doing a global service by taking refugees from Syria, and the population of Lebanon, not just because of reproduction in the country, but because of the war in the neighborhood, has skyrocketed. Well, there is also a policy lesson from this. If a country is doing that kind of regional or global public service, the international community has to step up. We cannot let this country to struggle only on its own. So careful analysis always can take you to very good policy conclusions. And then with more women at the top, very good things would happen. Look at the World Bank.
you don't need a report to tell you that. Dale, could I...
And I didn't mean myself. Look at this. Could you please, you ladies, get up? This is the World Bank row here.
Dale, could I bring you in? We have no sort of representative, in a sense, for produced capital here, for infrastructure. You know, China, obviously, for example, put in huge resources into infrastructure, roads, subways, factories, you know, cement, housing, etc. And if you are a well-governed country, let's say, with lots of natural resources, let's say lots of oil, how do you choose between, you know, what sort of choices should you make between building up your natural capital, which means investing, I guess, in health and education, technical skills, and you're building infrastructure. Is this a dichotomy? Is there an emphasis question here? How would you sort of assess
the key
that?
Idea here is the idea that we've just heard about, which is the idea of investment. This is a story about the relative importance of different components of wealth, beginning at the lowest level and rising to the highest level. What is involved in the processes of investment? The World Bank plays a very important role here, but the key thing turns out to be investment in the resources that we've talked about. We can talk specifically about investment in natural resources, but the big number is human capital. It turns out that we've got to think all along the way as we transform these countries into viable, sustainable, developing countries, and then ultimately into advanced economies, of the idea of investing in the basic resources being human resources. That is precisely the lesson of China. China has very, very impressive infrastructure, a high-speed rail that would be an asset to the United States. But what they have succeeded in doing is going from a very, very human capital poor to one of the better educated emerging economies, and their goal explicitly is to transform this into the human capital that's associated with advanced economies. They have a very clear idea about how to undertake the investment programs that are going to produce economic development on a sustainable basis. And it turns out to be primarily, as we've heard, a matter of building the human resources that will enable them to undertake this investment.
Why don't you come in, Danny, and then I know Andrew wanted to come in this question as well, and then I would like to open it up for questions.
On this question, the game-changing way of addressing that question is for it to become much of a less of a trade-off between the two.
Right.
So the pie, and the pie of investment, as you say, has to expand. Already a decade ago with my co-author at the World Bank, we did that study, and the importance of improved governance in the long run, it essentially reduces infant mortality, but by two-thirds increases human capital, and GDP per capita goes up by 3-1. So ultimately, that should not be such a huge trade-off. Uh-huh. Right now, in a handful of key Latin American countries, infrastructure investments are paralyzed. Let's be very frank. Why are they paralyzed? Because of the Petrobras Odebrecht scandal. Mm-hmm. And that has come to a complete halt because everything is frozen, and also in the judiciary, and we are suggesting ways, and others also, how that has to move forward. Again, such a poignant and potent example that ultimately, if we don't fully factor in the importance of institutions and governance, then you're going to be faced with a shrinking pie and with much more of that trade-off. Just to add, what you said is absolutely right. But one of the implications of what we are discussing is that it will be worth, and we can follow up later with the authors of the report, that it's quite likely, and we've been looking at the numbers, that poor governed countries, the evaluation of natural capital is overestimated because the potential of that to be fully transformed into effective wealth is much
stolen.
Less. So already that looked pretty dark, that picture there, but it may be in reality even more dark, so we need to redouble our focus and effort on these institutions.
Time's running out before we go to questions. Andrew, come in on that question. You seem to be keen.
You asked an interesting question about China and how does this help it, and I think Professor Jorgensen gave absolutely the right answer. But, you know, China would now admit that this kind of analysis is informing it how it actually made some mistakes. So, for example, it built loads of factories, and then it suddenly realizes, wait a minute, as this report says, 6 million people in the world are dying every year from air pollution, and over a million in China. And they say, wait a minute, we've got this wrong. And so if you go to China, well, as I did in December, beautiful blue skies in Beijing. Why? Because they've said, we want our natural capital, please, and we're going to run down or close down our man-made capital. They've closed steel mills. They've closed that. Fascinating sort of example of, could we please have our natural capital back, please? And, of course, you can have both.
Haven't they just moved it to the west of China? that might be a slight quibble with your... did you want to come in, Kristalina, briefly, and then I'll open up?
Very briefly... I want to thank Professor Jorgensen because what he's talking about is where we are taking the bank very decisively, understanding much better this correlation between investing in people and improving the conditions for growth, the potential for development. We have a big human capital project, so you would see us coming time and again on on that topic. And one of the things we realize is that investing in people actually is absolutely paramount if you want to have good institutions. It doesn't mean that you, if you have educated population, you will have good institutions. It is, but it is, if you don't have educated populations, you for sure are not going to have good institutions. It's kind of necessary but not sufficient condition, so let's make the necessary real.
But the reverse also.
Let me the reverse is also true.
I have another question I'd love to ask, but let's see if I have time to ask that. Let's have a question from this gentleman here. If you could just identify yourselves and then ask a brief question. Thank you very much.
Well, I'm Jed Schilling, and I spent a lot of time working at the World Bank with Andrew and several other people here. And this is really interesting because we started trying to introduce the natural, physical capital in some of the things and taking account of the depreciation. This work is making very important steps forward, but I think there are several things that I think need to be taken account. First, in setting up the priorities, I think we have to admit the most important priority of these assets is natural resources. Without air, water, food, none of the rest of us survive. So that's the basis for all the work that's being done. Then, of course, it's human capital that figures out how to organize it, produce and use it, and then the physical capital and the economic activity that does the production and things like that. And it's also very important to take account of the relations between these things. Andrew made a couple of good points that the was it the mango trees you were talking about? It's not just the production of the fruit, it's how it affects the water flow downstream and things like that. So we take account of that, or the pollution that we create causes a real damage to human capital and stuff like that. So we need to take account of these interrelations in looking how we go forward. A couple of natural resources that weren't mentioned that have become very strong constraints that I think to be taken account are water and something I just learned about, which is sand, which we need for so much construction and other things, are getting scarcer. And water, we've just heard that parts of South Africa are facing water depletion and other areas are depleting available sources. But you can deplete them for years and years and years, and then you hit the bottom and you're suddenly out of it. So all of these things is, and just one last comment. Since I left the bank, I work with the Millennium Institute. We've developed an integrated system dynamic model that links the economic, the social, human capital, and environmental factors and shows how they interact and generates longer-term scenarios to look at these impacts over a long period of time much more effectively than the World Bank models and stuff, which I did a lot of work. We actually did one in Bhutan, which included measuring gross national happiness.
I am going to have to ask for a question, or maybe there isn't one. I mean, is the question, do we need to think about thresholds as well? You can't just convert one form of capital into another and hope for the best. You may just, while you're doing that, hit a threshold that's catastrophic. Andrew?
Yes.
Okay, that was a very short answer to a very long question. We have a question here and then one here. Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you. I'm Per Kurovsky. Hearing here about the human resources being valued, human capital being valued, and discounting sort of future incomes in these days when we see have robots, artificial intelligence threatening around the corner, makes it very, very difficult to try to identify an appropriate discount rate. There's so much volatility in some of these issues, so that volatility has to be impacting the final figures too. There are some things you can predict a little bit safer.
Okay, there's a broader question there, if I might, which is that GDP is criticised for being a backward-looking measure. Wealth accounting is, by definition, really a forward-looking measure. But we can't. The problem is we can't know anything about the future. We certainly can't know everything about the future. What do you think about that, Castellino?
Well, okay, going back to my analogy with the car. Yes, GDP is to drive looking at your rearview mirror only. Very dangerous way to drive. And with wealth accounting, we can project in the future. And of course, it's like you put your lights to see as much as you can of the road, but you sure don't see the end of the road.
Right.
And you have to accept a degree of uncertainty in your projections. What it means for us is that we have to work hard on making sure that we have as sound methodology as possible.
Yes.
And recognize that this is one of many inputs for policy makers. It is not going to be the input ever.
Dale and then Danny. So Dale, I mean, we've got these very precise numbers for lifetime earnings, but this could all be wrecked by robots and AI. We may think that we can earn a certain amount and our job might be taken away.
Well, the key idea is that you've got to bring to bear detailed data. And that's what the World Bank has succeeded in doing. They have incorporated the most detailed data that is available to estimate human capital, and they've captured the great heterogeneity that characterizes human capital from the point of view of the kind of investment that's involved. The key step, though, and this is something I don't think anybody has emphasized enough, and that is that the World Bank is changing its role. It is not only providing capital, that is to say, providing loans and financial resources. It is providing knowledge and the understanding of the development process. That's what this report represents. It represents the forward edge of what the World Bank is becoming. And I think all of us owe the World Bank our congratulations. I'd just like to mention one thing, and that is that with regard to China, we talked a little bit about that. This turns out to be the country where information about human capital is best developed. This is an area of research that the Chinese have pioneered with the help of my collaborator, Barbara Frommany, who's worked there for a period of 10 years, helping them improve their estimates. The last report, the one before this, 5 years ago from the World Bank, incorporated a summary of the Chinese study by the leader, Hai Zheng Li. And this is an indication of the direction that they were going to go, and they have succeeded in this report in arriving at something that is very useful.
Thank you. Can I bring in Danny on this question?
To complement what was said, but in the next stage, I think it's incredibly important. We are in near 2020. There has to be, for credibility, scenario planning. We are dealing with known unknowns.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Known unknown means that, and since the future comes in so potently, net present value, into this analysis, there have to be different scenarios. You alluded to that. One builds three, four scenarios. Out of that, let's be totally transparent and precise, and we have tried to do that in governance, about margins of error.
Yes.
What is the range, rather than an artificial sense of precision? Because it's incredibly valuable, as you said. But this is within a range. Third, let's incorporate those unknowns. What you're talking about, and the institutional capital that we're talking about.
Yes. Mm-hmm. So you could be a bus driver in Delhi, but your job is replaced by a driverless bus, and you could have lots of oil, but you find you can't, because of regulations and tax, you can never use it. Question here from this gentleman.
Yep.
And then we'll go to the back. Lots of questions. That's great.
Hi. My name is Anupam Khanna. I used to be at the bank too. And I think indeed I was also present at the genesis of when Kirk Hamilton and his team did this, but also when Joe pushed this. And I'd like to say there were three other trends that Stiglitz was trying to pull together, why he thought this idea of wealth of nations was important. He didn't get very far in the bank, but then he pursued it later. One was the capabilities approach that Amartya Sen was saying.
Yeah.
So to bring in the second one that was actually at the heart of internal criticism of his, which was the fact that we were also in the throes of the privatization and PSP mania, and he was very concerned people were looking at privatization receipts as, selling of stocks and converting them into income flows.
Yes.
So that was another. There were two other things. Fund was also trying to come up with the balance sheet approach. I'm going to, my question, I now live in India most of the time. I'm going to change the World Bank and rest on its laurels. I think looks like a very good report. But you can do indicators, inter-country comparisons. But when you try to operationalize, and as a matter of fact, for the last 8 years, I've been trying to operationalize some of these, there's certain policy questions. And the difficulty goes beyond the intuition of converting future earnings into this. And there are four areas, and I'm wondering how they're being dealt with. One is, of course, the discount rate that Andrew has mentioned. The other bigger problem that we've confronted, and I'll give you three examples.
I won't give examples. Can you come to a question, actually?
Yeah, the question is, how do you treat, I don't know if they've dealt with the whole issue of discount value, the environment, but the pricing issue in human capital is very, very difficult. The third one is inter-country comparison because of the global talent flows. And the fourth is organizational capital. These are two areas which are very much at the forefront of research here. Just to give you, I'm sitting in India in the company. When I look at the asset value of my earnings there, they're 10 times, my asset value of my earnings in the US, same person, same capital, than if I'm based in India. Not only that, as we know, in this country, if you're working in a firm with...
So I'm going to have to stop because there's a lot of people want to ask questions and we're going to run out of time.
These are the difficulties in actually doing it. Mm-hmm. It affects privatization of Air India. Just to give you a concrete example.
I don't think we can have an example, sorry.
No, but I'm saying these are policy issues, and unless you know how to operationalize them, you can't go beyond, you have to go beyond.
All right, so we've got the discount rate and the sort of and how to operationalize these and cross-country comparisons. Let's take another couple of questions, one at the back there and one here.
Makin Maghrebi. Currently, I'm a diplomat, but as a journalist that served in East Africa for 20 years, I think I went through the other side of this question. The confusion is that when you count the natural resources, you should count the natural disasters, because you can't just take the positive side of the nature. If you take the nature, the reference.
I heard you say question, but I'm not hearing the question. Can you just?
Okay. I think there is a confusion. How you solve this confusion?
The confusion is what now?
Okay.
So how do you solve the confusion between?
Between having the positive side of the natural resources and ignoring the natural disasters. Just like desertification
and
active volcanoes and others.
Okay, that's for Andrew. Thank you. And one here.
Thank you. I'd like to offer a question. I'm Eagles Milbergs. I'm co-founder of a nonprofit in Seattle dealing with water innovation, water infrastructure. My question, the implications of this report, groundbreaking report for public policy, are pretty clear in my mind. You know, investing in human capital, sustainability, et cetera, it all makes sense. But most decisions are made in the private sector. So what are the implications of these kinds of measurements at the firm level or micro level?
Okay.
You know, we're talking at the macro level.
Yeah.
What can we do at the micro level here and the impact it might have on the private sector if they were to adopt measures like this?
Okay, those are all great questions. Andrew, why don't we start with you with natural disasters?
Well, if you went to Davos 2 weeks ago, you know they do this risk assessment each year. 1,000 CEOs are asked what risks in terms of likelihood and impact. So for all of these are CEOs of major companies. Number one risk in the two, both impact and probability, extreme weather events. Number two, failure to address climate change. Number three, water. Mm-hmm. And this is all about natural capital. That's what they're worrying about. If you go and talk, as I did, with some of these CEOs of companies like PepsiCo, they say, what am I worried about? I'm worried about water availability. Mm-hmm. That's natural capital. So, yes, we absolutely need to factor that in. And so we need to factor also in, how do you deal with climate change? Well, you deal with the stock of bad things in the air. And if each year that passes, there's a greater probability that we're going to have natural disasters, that is your natural capital declining. And so, again, for next time, I mean, we need to try and factor that in as well. And I think you're very honest, again, as to the need to do that.
And, Andrew, while I've got you, do you want to comment on any of the other? So there was the private sector, the kind of the micro implications of this, and then there were the questions about
the cross-country. I would love to hear Professor Jorgensen, who is, in a way, the... grandfather of all, well, you're not a grandfather, but you're the guru who
I am a
you are a grandfather of all this work. So issues like this pricing across countries being differently, discount rate, I would defer my time.
Well, Professor Jorgensen.
I think the basic lesson here is essentially that what we need to do is design market institutions. That's partly an issue of government governance. But the goal for the World Bank and for us as analysts is essentially to deal with the issue of how do you design institutions. And here is where measures like the ones in this report come to bear. They provide the accounting system not in the form that a business person could use to make decisions about whether to invest more money in fossil fuels or whatever, but rather the information that includes all of wealth. And that turns out to be 70%, at least for the world economy, human capital. We have to design institutions that will build the ability to invest and invest fruitfully in situations where we don't have standard markets, financial markets. That's where the World Bank has an extremely important role to play, because they are going to create market-like institutions. In the case of environmental work, that's going to be market-based institutions for dealing with environmental problems, including climate change. And for human beings, it's going to be dealing with what turns out to be the wealth of the world. And building institutions like that may seem to be overly ambitious. I think that the World Bank deserves our admiration for taking on this this task and deploying the kind of talent that it can only it can mobilize to move investment and managing the world economy in a fruitful new direction. That's what this report is saying to us.
The question may be, Kristalina, about cross-country comparisons, or did you want to?
Two things. One is on the private sector.
Yes.
What at micro level is of interest in this report? I think there are two useful for private investors aspects of it. The first one is that looking into the wealth and how wealth is being managed at the country you invest is as important as knowing how well it is doing in terms of GDP, consumer spending, and so forth. Because if you don't look at the quality of assets and how they're managed, it may be doing very well at the moment, but longer term, you may be in trouble. And second, it tells you that you have interest to actually care about investing in skills and people. And that in terms of where your tax money goes in a country, you should have you should think about it. You should not. This is not irrelevant for you. I think that it is not meant to be a guide to investor in a particular country, but it is useful input for investors as they make decisions. It is more kind of a here high level, but it is still useful input. On cross-country comparison, we have 141 countries in this report. We will strive to increase the number. It is truly remarkable when you look at the data on groupings and then you look at individual country data, how much you can learn about the country's current status and future prospects. It would confirm certain things, certain trends that we broadly know. It would give you additional pointers for these trends. And I certainly believe that looking at the wealth per capita in particular, the calculations on wealth per capita, really, really enlightening.
Thank you. Danny.
I mentioned very briefly before, in addition to the wealth measure, which are very important in this report, there is also a very important flow measure, and that's the adjusted net savings,
yes.
Which takes into account starts with GDP, but then adds and subtract other elements which are not in GDP, particularly the whole issue of pollution and depletion. It's not fully there, as Sandra suggests, because there's much of environmental damage and climate change is not fully there, but the framework is there. And that would be a very important measure for investment in terms of management resources. Sorry to say, Angola, the adjusted net savings, if I recall correctly, looking at the report, is minus 50% of GDP, while Chile is highly positive. So again, it's not a competition between stocks and flows. All of these are important and they're complementary to each other. So look at that. Now, if in addition we manage to integrate, which is difficult, but we can do it, these institutional measures, they're incredibly important for investors. Right now, the risk rating agencies use all our indicators on governance and so on. If that could be clearly integrated into these, that would be additionally useful.
We have time for one more question. Let's go. I feel terrible now. And let's go here. It's just easier. The gentleman in the blue shirt. Sorry, everybody else.
Thank you. I'm just an interested citizen, and thanks to Brookings and World Bank for having this session. One thing that wasn't mentioned is the stock of technology or ideas, patents, et cetera, for the difference in prosperity between countries. What's the thinking on why that's not included?
Okay. So patents, technology, ideas. Are they somehow? Are they there somewhere, or is this an extra element?
I'm looking at the authors to answer this question.
Okay. It's implicit in the next presentation.
As you say, it is a very important element, and if you look at the national accounts over the last couple of decades, this research and development information has become an increasingly important component. We have certain constraints in the data that we use because we have to cover a large number of countries, and we don't have that kind of information for a very large number of countries, but as you say, it is very critical.
So, chapter 11.
We may just have time. This gentleman here has been very patient.
Chapter 11.
Yes.
This country.
Thank you very much. I came in late, so if this has been addressed, excuse me. But what does leadership play in these issues that we're talking about? It seems to me that as America continues to withdraw from the international stage, we're losing some leadership, or what we thought was leadership, especially in the three issues that those 1,000 CEOs in Davos talked about, the climate and the weather and all the rest of that. So as we move away, who's going to take the leadership positions in all of this? Thank you.
When you mentioned Davos, actually, I thought you were going to talk about a man-made disaster. leadership. Does anyone want to address the leadership question? Okay, just...
Just one from Davos. The best speech at Davos was given by President Macron. And he said, if we are going to lead into the future, we have three obligations. The first is invest in the future. It's all about education. He spoke for maybe 15 minutes. Second thing we have to do is to share. And the third thing we have to do is to protect. It's great leadership, but it's like he'd read this report. And by the way, just because I'm talking about a natural capital doesn't mean I don't believe that human capital is the most important.
Here with my wonky hat, and thanks to Dale was also my teacher, not just Homi's. So every mistake I make, it's mine, but all the, if there's anything useful comes in terms of statistics, data comes from Dale. But this is addressable and measurable. Talking about the private sector, companies have been already, inroads have been made in measuring intangibles. Reputational, brand, and so on. And this is what we are talking about of what's not yet measured here. Of course, it's on a national level, has different implications, and how to figure it out in terms of discount rates and so on. But when we talk about institutions, about trust, and about leadership, that can be done. So the question is absolutely key. What's happening here, a few blocks from here, is an erosion in those intangibles. And that matters not only for the U.S., but for many other countries in the world. That is nowadays measurable with margins of error, but it is measurable.
And of course, the treatment of R&D has been changed in national accounts in the GDP treatment. So, I mean, so you can account for these in different ways. It doesn't just have to be in wealth accounts. I'm not going to try and sum up, but all I will say as we come to a close is I think that this discussion has really shown that looking at things through a different prism, here the prism of wealth, can throw different light on policies. Just one thing that came up, for example, the sort of privatization rage, which actually now is being looked at more critically in Britain, in my own country, which you could see as a conversion of, you know, stock of wealth into a quick flow. Professor Collier, in a previous discussion, mentioned debt. You know, the one bit of stock that we tend to look at is debt. But if it's looked at in isolation, that might be misleading, because if you borrow to invest in something else and that something else is useful, then you might think that that's a very valuable trade-off. If you borrow to blow all that money on consumption, then you might think that that's a very unuseful thing to do. So in other words, looking at these things more holistically, which I think this report helps us to do, you know, is a way of really refining policy and also just thinking about things differently. So I think the World Bank is to be commended.
That's our model, holistically.
Holistically, as is our panel. So I'm going to wrap it up here. I'm going to thank everybody online and in the audience, and most of all, the panel. Thank you very much. Thank you.